We were very lucky this History Week to be joined in the Henry Carmichael Theatre by Michelle Scott Tucker and Rachel Franks. So they joined us to tease apart the incredible story of Louisa Lawson, the trailblazing writer, fearless suffragist, and champion for women's rights in Australia. Michelle is an author and the State Library of New South Wales visiting scholar. Rachel is an author, academic, and the coordinator of scholarship at the State Library of New South Wales. So we were thrilled to hold the event at the SMSA. As you probably know, Louisa Lawson is a historical member of ours, so it was great to dive into our own history. Michelle is embarking on a very exciting journey with Louisa. She's writing a biography at the State Library of New South Wales using their collection. So together, Rachel and Michelle will explore Louisa's impact then and now on Sydney society, the SMSA, and the State Library. This event was recorded at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is located on Gadigal land.
Okay, so thank you all very much for coming. I would like to start by saying that we both looked ridiculously sexy when we left the State Library of New South Wales earlier this afternoon, but there was a perfectly timed weather event that exactly matched our trot from the library to here, and we could save our hair or our handbags. So anyway, it was quite an event, but we are here and dried out. And so thank you all very much for coming. It is so exciting to have Michelle as a visiting scholar at the State Library of New South Wales, where I look after our fellows and scholars. So I just sort of sit around and help people do fabulous stuff, really. It's a great job. But this has been particularly fascinating because so many people at the library, when Michelle was first appointed, was kind of like, oh, we know that story. And now that you're a few months in, nearly 10 months in now, it's like, wow, we really didn't know that story at all. So for a woman's name that is in popular culture and many of us are familiar with it, but we actually, very few of us know her well. So I'd like to start with the obvious question of how did you two meet?
Me and Louisa? Yeah, it wasn't on Twitter. I met her when I was reading about Henry, actually, which is a bit unfortunate, but I was reading about Henry and many of his biographers write about his mother and portray her as a monster. Because, as you might know, Henry fell on hard times. He had a problem with alcohol, he had a problem with his wife, he had a problem with earning money. He's the first person to tell you about most of the problems that he had. He liked a wine, our Henry. And most of his biographers attribute those problems to his mother. And so that got me interested, because whenever a woman's described as a monster, I want to find out more, because they're often the most interesting people, and that is definitely the case. Strangely, his absent father never gets ascribed any of the blame for anything that was going on, and Henry himself doesn't get ascribed much of the blame, and Henry complains about his mother a lot as well, so that's probably got something to do with it. But that's how I met her, as a monster and wanting to find out more.
So while you were doing your own investigations, and we'll come to how you find out more about a woman whose story is so often told by people that perhaps not deliberately misrepresent her, but at least casually do it because, what, it's easy?
Yeah.
Because the archival research around this woman, which we are going to talk a bit about tonight, is challenging. You know, we like to talk about the gap in the archive happening to other people, but it's actually happening here. So while you were first becoming better acquainted with her, what was, you know, like, to trouble that whole monster narrative, what was the thing about her that startled you the most when you came across it as her story?
It's less about her and more about startled by the times she lived in. So we know that she was one of the advocates for getting women the vote. And she used her newspaper, The Dawn, as a voice to drive social change, really. And the reason why she wanted women to have the vote was not for some high and mighty esoteric reason, because it's the right thing to do. She wanted women to have the vote to drive social change for women. And the shocking part for me has been discovering how bad things were for women at that time. Appalling doesn't come close to how bad things were. Infanticide was a thing, because if you have no social, if you're pregnant or you're a single mother and you have no social support and no government support, no family support, infanticide begins to look like an option, and in fact was an option for some women. The workplaces for women were appalling, and you think now about sexual harassment in the workplace. Well, 100 years ago, that was 1,000 times worse. And so there's so many problems that Louisa was addressing in her newspaper, The Dawn, but also she hoped and believed that if women got the vote, they would vote for women's issues and drive social change that way. So the shocking part for me is really the times that she lived in.
Of her. Yeah. So we've had a couple of conversations over the last year or so about how difficult it is for you to convince people that Louisa's story has actually not yet been told. So we have all these narratives around Henry, where she's like a bit part and not a necessarily very attractive person. There are a couple of more sympathetic or more comprehensive biographies of her, but yet in many ways her story still hasn't been systematically unpacked and shared. So can you tell us all a little bit about how frustrating that is? It's like, but wait, there is more, and what you've been doing to convince people that the story not only hasn't been told, but desperately needs to be told.
So some of you might remember in 1987, Brian Matthews published a biography called Louisa, about Louisa Lawson. And it was terrific. And I was at uni a couple of years after that. Please don't do the math. And I read it at uni and I thought it was wonderful, and I went back to it when I was thinking about writing about Louisa, and I went back to it, and it's a remarkable read. It's so readable and vibrant. It's not really about Louisa. It's a biography about writing biography. It's a meta-biography, I guess. So you hear a lot about, there's really three people in that book. There's Louisa, there's the biographer, and then there's a fictional third person that the biographer invents to bounce off some of his ideas about. And in 1987, that was remarkable, because you're unpicking about, here's the evidence, what do I think about that? 40 years later, that's not quite so remarkable, and there's a few biographies that along the way will talk to you about the evidence and will position the biographer as a player in the narrative, whereas in, you know, 50 years ago, you'd never use, a biographer would never say I. They were an absent third person, omniscient narrator saying, I know everything there is to know about this person and here's the information. Now, that's changed a lot. But Louisa's, that biography of Louisa in 1987 was much less about Louisa and much more about biography. Now, it happens that I live in the country, and a retired historian from the ANU has moved to the shire that I live in, and I took him out for coffee because he's a charming human being. And he knew Brian Matthews. He was a historian with him. And he said, even Brian said, people aren't going to write a proper biography of Louisa now.
Oh, that's so interesting. Mm.
And he, Brian was worried about that at the time, because he'd sort of done this thing for a reason to unpack what biography is, but he was aware that it would put a damper on Louisa Lawson's studies.
She was really just a tool. She was just a convenient mechanism, a good title for the book.
I think so. And Brian Matthews was a Henry Lawson scholar, so he certainly knew about Louisa and knew that story was there. But that biography of Louisa, it's 40 years old, so you know you come at it with a fresh pair of eyes. But it's really not so much about Louisa as she deserves.
Will you use first person when you're writing about her?
I'm still working that through. I think I probably will, which fills me with fear and anxiety, because I omniscient narrator's easier. Here's the interesting thing. We think this. And putting yourself into the narrative is tricky. I'm still playing with the idea of structure. So I have a contract to write this biography. It's the manuscript is due in the middle of 2026, which everyone tells me, oh, that's heaps of
plenty
time.
Plenty of time.
Not enough time. I'm terrified. Not enough time. So I'm still working out what the narrative structure might be. I'm thinking maybe take the existing objects, like her wedding ring that exists, it's at the library, you and I were looking at it a few months ago, and use that as the basis of a discussion around her marriage and her advocacy for women's rights within marriage, and use that as a jumping off point for a wider conversation, rather than just, or, you know, if I chicken out, I might just do the standard linear narrative. She was born here, died over here, stuff happened in the middle. We'll see how scared I get.
The different ways of writing a biography now, there's so many different approaches that you can take. It's almost as complicated doing that structure and the thinking about it as it is to sort of do that research. And you've done biography before. I am very new to biography. My approach when my publisher said, oh, we'd like some first person, Rachel, and my strategy was the manuscript's due in a year, they'll forget. spoiler alert, publishers actually, they don't forget
anything. Are they like elephants?
They really are. But with the works that you've already done, and one is collaborative and one is more a traditional, you went in there and you researched it and you did all the things. Yeah. But as a ratio of researching, writing and planning and just thinking about what is this going to look like, how does that sort of split up for you in your process?
I write the sort of books I want to read. The ones that keep you sitting up going, I'll just read one more chapter even though you have to get up for work in the morning. And so readability is very important to me. So with the Elizabeth MacArthur one, I was attracted to biography simply because it is that straightforward. You've got a narrative arc already worked out for you because of the life. But then I started reading some really interesting creative nonfiction and thought I can play with this. So that book begins when at the worst moment in Elizabeth MacArthur's life, when she loses a baby, and then we flash back to why she's at that position to lose the baby, and then we go forward in text. I did the same thing when I was working with Aaron. We start at a fairly interesting moment when he's 15, and then you sort of set the scene and then you go back. And then even I'm talking about how the narrative arc is straightforward, but it's not, because you've got to draw in a whole lot of things. So with Elizabeth MacArthur, well, when do I talk about the sheep? At which point do I talk about the sheep? The sheep are there for the whole time, but do I talk about them the whole time? Probably not. Or do I put them in here or do I put them in there? So you've always sort of got these narrative decisions to make, even though you're using the arc of a life. So that's why with this Louisa Lawson one, I might play around with that structure a little bit. I still want to have the reader to have that sense of the timeline of her life, but I might come at it, if I can, and if I can work out how to do it, in slightly different directions. But my overall driver is narrative readability, page turneringness.
Just one more page. And that's kind of really interesting, the point about the sheep, because those plot points, if you like, if you think of them as, you know, structuring a life as structuring a novel, if you are going for that type of readability, to concentrate some of the dull repetitiveness that is real life without then making it repetitive for the reader.
Yeah.
That's hard work.
It is hard work, and it annoys me. I had this conversation on Twitter just the other day. How often reviews of a biography will summarise the story of the life and not say anything about the literary quality of the text itself. as if they assume that a biography or any work of nonfiction is not a work, not also a work of literary creativity. Mm. When of course it is. I'm here to tell you it's hard work. I've just written a novel for children, and that was fun because you got to make stuff up. Who knew? But the intellectual requirements of each isn't different. And making a biography readable and of high quality is it's a literary effort and a literary work, and I'm not ashamed to step back from that. And you should push for reviews that assess your nonfiction as works of literature as well as just summarising what's in the plot for you.
That's actually a really interesting comment. So the State Library of New South Wales this year for the very first time advertised for a new fellowship, the Imago Fellowship, for creative writing, fiction or non-fiction in any genre. And the anonymous donor wants it to go to an emerging writer. So we had many arguments trying to work out what is an emerging writer. So an academia emerging is someone who is within 5 years of graduating from their PhD. So we set the bar at the same level. So it's within 5 years of your first full-length published work. And the number of people who rang me and said, oh, but I only wrote a biography, or I only wrote a history of X, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. It wasn't creative. And I was shocked that people who actually, you picture them sweating and anguishing over every sentence, fretting over punctuation and paragraph breaks, so not only how it reads, how it looks on the page, all of those things, how that is not every aspect of it.
It's not. I think it's more like collage. So you've got a non-fiction, you've got a whole lot of facts. You've done all your research, you've got all these facts in front of you, you're working on someone with their life and you've got all these plot points, but then you have to arrange them in a certain way, but you're also choosing which ones to use and which ones not to choose. Some of them get left out. So, for instance, in the life of this Torres Strait Islander, you won't see him going to the supermarket shopping. He does in his real life. He goes to the supermarket, you know, he buys toilet roll like us. But that's not in there because it's a creative choice to choose what's in and what's not. And as I go through the Louisa Lawson research, I've got an eye out for the telling anecdote that gives us some insight into what she's like as a person, or that I could frame as some insight.
And you
Sorry,
have,
I interrupted you.
No, you have another challenge. I was going to say problem, but we don't say that to other writers. You have a challenge. So, I mean, this is your second biography of a woman. So there's a pattern. Elizabeth MacArthur, you have to battle the wife of syndrome. And for Louisa Lawson, you have to battle the mother of syndrome.
Yeah.
Are they both as hard as each other? Are they both as irritating, those arguments to have?
They are and they aren't. I suspect Louisa will be easier because Elizabeth was so nice. She was just so nice. I suspect her descendants have edited her letters because they're uniformly cheerful and she never complains about anything. And I had to find things for her to just turn her into a real person who had faults, whereas Louisa's got heaps. She's a bit rough around the edges and she annoys people and she goes in and fights for things and gets... I've been reading the minutes of the SMSA from 1890, the Whist Club. Oh, my goodness. The Whist Club.
What is that?
There was a club. They played whist within the SMSA. They set up their own little club. They were gambling.
Wow.
The skullduggery that goes on in those minutes. It's terrific. But Louise is very... She's gets fed up with them all really quickly because, like any committee, they're all very, oh, let's do that next week, or we'll put that off till next month, or we'll look into it and come back to it, and that drove her nuts. And so she churns through committees pretty quick because she gets sick of all that sort of stuff and ends up leaving them behind. So I think the mother of stuff will be interesting to explore, because even she was fed up with being the mother of Henry. So in 1896 she was interviewed for the Bulletin, and was interviewed about her as a writer and as a businesswoman. And I think she was pretty excited about it. And I found a letter in her beautiful handwriting in your beautiful library that basically said, one day I will be more than the poet's mother. Because even in that article about her, she was framed as the poet's mother. So even she was fed up with that framing, and particularly later as she and Henry fell out, because she was strictly teetotal and couldn't bear the fact that he was a drinker, and it caused all sorts of problems. So I think I'll probably lean into it more than I did with Elizabeth MacArthur.
So you've mentioned a few archival materials already this evening. So you're looking at minutes, there's correspondence, there's the wedding ring.
Yep.
What other sorts of things are you looking at that's allowing you to sort of have options that you can choose from to build this story?
Yeah. So we're graced with over 200 editions of The Dawn. So that ran from, you're going to help me out here, from May 1888 until mid-1905, so for 17 years. So there's over 200 editions of that magazine. And if you don't know it, it's wonderful. It's kind of like a prototype Australian Women's Weekly, in that the opening pages, there's lots of ads, and I want to talk about ads soon, but there's the opening editorial is usually something about current affairs and usually something about fabulous about women. Sydney University opening the doors to women, for instance, or women warders being appointed in the jail. So she starts with some hard-hitting current affairs, then there's often a short story or a poem or some more articles about things that are happening for women overseas, and then she moves into the proper care of gloves and how to make your house smell nice, and first aid and how to ride a horse. I can ride a horse. Her article on how to ride a horse was awful. but that's interesting as well.
Is the glove content good?
The glove content's fantastic. In later editions, there's a children's corner. So she's trying to cater for everyone in a marketing sense, but also she's recognising that women like all the things. All the things. We want to know about the political stuff, and we want the glove content as well. And we want to know how to make our houses smell nice, and we also want to know that women are being admitted to Sydney University, because that's really interesting. And so she didn't pander to women. The Bulletin had a women's page shortly afterwards that was very woman's pagey. But she acknowledged the whole woman, if you like. And I found that really interesting. So I'm going to draw on The Dawn, because that's the most we have of her writings and her political sense. We have much less of her inner writings. We don't have many personal letters from her to someone else. We don't have a dear diary, you know, today I walked to the shops. We don't. The inner life of her is going to be much harder to capture, and we'll probably need to do that through the prism of her children's eyes, which is never perfect. Who hands up who wants their biography to be written by their children? Not me. So The Dawn will be really important, I think, and it's just been an absolute privilege to go to the library and the actual editions of The Dawn there, and I'm allowed to touch them and hold them. And not only did Louisa write The Dawn and edit The Dawn, she was a printer. She printed The Dawn. She produced it. She had her own print shop to make the physical artefact that is that magazine, and she employed 10 women as printers in her print shop at a time when that wasn't necessarily a common thing to do, although it had been done in England before, I discovered it. Someone else had done something similar. The union who disallowed women as members went off their trolley when they found out that these women were working the print shop, and went out of their way to harass the women at their work, and they tried to get advertisers to boycott The Dawn. So there's a whole little drama in there. You can see the telling of it. That's going to be, you know, a really marvellous story. But The Dawn will be useful for all sorts of reasons. It's just a treasure trove. It really is.
And you picked up, ashamed to say this, some of the issues are missing.
Yes. So the library catalogue said, we've got all the Dawns. And I went, oh, this is exciting. They've got all the Dawns. And so I got them, went to the library and said, can you give me all the Dawns, please? And they brought out all the Dawns in the big boxes. And I went back and I went, you don't have all the Dawns. And Rachel looked a bit sad.
Indignant we were. Of course we have all the Dawns. Anyway, we had a team of very diligent librarians. The cataloguers couldn't work out what was going on. The shelvers couldn't work out what was going on. I was pacing nervously up and down. I didn't know what was going on. Because we pride ourselves on holding, you know, the story of New South Wales. And this is, you know, it's such a great story. And even if we might not have time to unpick it ourselves, we jolly well want to make sure that it's there so that someone can come along and do that fine work. And just this idea that we had the full set, somebody said it and then it was just replicated and people saying, oh, yes, come and look at the full set of the Dawn, now digitised and on Trove. It's not all there. No. So you've been doing a lot of work asking people to
I have. So check. There's 11 editions.
Check at home.
Yeah. So the first edition is there in May 1888, which is exciting, is the first edition. And then a year later, the anniversary edition is there for May 1889. And in that anniversary edition, she editorialises about the year that's been and talks about the editions. But those 11 editions from that first year are missing, so we don't get to see her evolution as a writer, as an editor, as a newspaper proprietor across those that crucial first year of the Dawn. Now, I expect she's pretty consistent in what she does, so I'm not expecting something outrageously unusual to be in those 11 editions, but wouldn't it be lovely to find them? I've been on the radio, you know, telling people that, you know, to look under their beds. I spoke to the University of New England today hoping that they'd have a full set, but I think they've just got a microfiched copy of what's in your library. So, but they think they also, their catalogue also says we've got the full set. They don't have the full set. So this is an adventure. So if you could just tell all your friends to keep an eye out, if they've got any copies of the Dawn under their beds, we'd love to see them.
Or fruit boxes in garages.
Yeah.
The extraordinary archival material that has been delivered to libraries across the country in a damp fruit box, it's kind of bonkers. So hopefully they are out there somewhere, although there was a call, was it in the 80s somebody tried to find?
Yeah. So in 1980, late 80s, early 90s, Louise's great-granddaughter, maybe great-great-granddaughter, great-granddaughter, Olive, her name was, she published a book with excerpts from the Dawn in it. And at that time she did a call out for copies of the Dawn, and she wasn't able to find the full set of missing ones then either. And there was also a fire in Louise's office at some point, so perhaps they've always been missing. It's hard to know.
Nice to have the puzzle solved one way or the other. So is there anything else that you've come across so far? Like the minute books, obviously very interesting, and just that churn and that intolerance of sort of, you know how some people feel obliged to stay on the committee.
Yes.
It's years later and they still dread going, but they turn up dutifully.
Yes.
That's a lot of feisty to just sort of say, nah, I'm not doing this anymore.
Look, I think it is. And also the women's movement then as now was a collective movement. And there was lots of women working towards the same aims, each with slightly different agendas. And surprise, surprise, they didn't always get along. Or they'd started getting along and then they wanted to push in different directions. It's hard to work as a committee. It's really, really hard. And so Louisa, like everyone else, fell in and fell out of committees. Other committee members fell in and fell out with her. Yes, she was forthright and a bit feisty and in your face. She's also very much a working class woman. So she was born into rural poverty, lived on a farm until she was 35 and farmed successfully, or more or less successfully, like did the hard yards herself before she moved to Sydney in her late 30s. And she's then mixing with the women of the women's movement who are very much self-funded middle-class ladies or aristocratic ladies, in some cases the wife of judges and wealthy men. So that class issue has to be a factor as well, and it is something I really want to explore in some depth about how she was and wasn't accepted by the progressive women of Sydney. And in some cases she was actively excluded, which is just a bit rich, really.
So you have this idea of reclaiming her as her own person and not the poet's mother, but at some point, inevitably, you do have to make Henry part of the story.
Yeah.
Now, traditionally, a lot of Australians don't like their icons challenged, so it's actually not a straightforward task for you to address him and include him in the story. So you've got this great Australian poet as the popular conception, and then the more you get to know him, he's actually a deeply unpleasant bloke, isn't he? So how are you going to, are you just going to, it is what it is?
Yeah, I'm pretty much going to lean into the unpleasant bloke. And be damned. I think it's maybe 50 years ago he was more on a pedestal than he is now. I think most people accept that Henry could write like an angel, but he wasn't a very nice fella. And I think that'll be okay. I'm finding more and more when I'm telling people about this project and I say, oh, I'm writing about Louisa Lawson, he's Henry Lawson's mother, heaps of people don't know who Henry Lawson is. It's
wow.
Kind of terrifying. Heaps of people don't know who Henry Lawson is. And I have to explain. So I don't think there's going to be that much of an uproar. Okay. It might be a sort of, you know, storm in a teacup sort of thing.
And that's actually an interesting part of the story too, isn't it? How he has been held and then he is now into a bit of a...
That's right. And I think his name remains alive because of the drover's wife. And that the many, many retellings, is one here with us tonight, of The Drover's Wife. There's Leah Purcell's movie, film, book. I love the way she took that content and just milked it for all it was worth. The Drover's Wife is the main thing that people would know about, and people know The Drover's Wife even if they don't know who Henry Lawson is. But Louisa Lawson's got a part to play in The Drover's Wife story as well. Most of Henry's biographers will claim that the woman who is the drover's wife is his mother, and that he's the boy within that story, and it's sort of vaguely biographic. But Louisa Lawson, 3 years before The Drover's Wife was published, wrote her own non-fiction piece called The Bush Woman that was published overseas in a British magazine. And the similarities between the two stories go beyond coincidence, frankly. Is it plagiarism when your children steal your stuff? I don't know. So there's some interesting stories to pick out there as well.
I mean, I have...
You hate him even more now, don't you?
Well, hate's a strong word, but, I mean, I've always had a, you know, firm grudge against the man because he was so mean to Miles Franklin. And he was the one that lost the manuscript...
Yeah.
For My Brilliant Career. And it's kind of like, mate, really? Just...
Accidentally on purpose lost it, I reckon. And he was mean to his wife. I mean, his wife divorced him on the grounds of cruelty. And then he went to jail because he failed to pay what we would now call child support. So... Yes. Yeah, he was in and out of jail all the time. And he was clearly abusive to his wife as well. So, yeah, he's not a top bloke.
That's not a neat segue into my next planned question. But, look, I have a plan. I'm going to charge ahead. And while I stumble through this and try and make it make some sense in light of what we've just discussed, we're going to open up to you all soon for some questions. So do think about what you would like to ask Michelle, take advantage of her expertise while she's here. So, for impact on Australian culture and society, who do you think we owe a greater debt to, Louisa or Henry? Spoiler alert.
Well, I would say Louisa, wouldn't I? I suspect Henry had the greater cultural impact because he invented nostalgia for Australia. He invented a past that Australians at the turn of the century, when Federation was a thing, could be nostalgic about, whereas in the past there was all the convict stain and he didn't want to talk about it, whereas Henry invented this bush, this terrible place in the bush, but, you know, that Australians, white Australians, could identify with. He keeps talking about the terrible silence, and I think we all know what that silence was, don't we? The silence that the white Australians at that time weren't talking about. Mm. I also noticed that he's got a story called The Hairy Man, which is like a Yowie figure, and he posits that as absolutely a Bushman's story about the Yowie figure, but that's deeply entrenched in Aboriginal mythology and Torres Strait Islander mythology as well, actually. And so there's some interesting streams coming through. So in terms of cultural impact, probably Henry over the long term. In terms of political impact, certainly his mother. Look, I'd love to give her entire credit for getting women the vote, but it was a group effort and she was one of a group who were doing it. She fell out with them in the end and just stepped back and used the Dawn as a voice to push that through. But getting women the vote was no small thing. Like, that is huge, and particularly now, 120 years later, when women's rights feel like they're going backwards in many parts of the world, what she did then has huge resonance for us now. And the fact that she stood up and was vilified and got called names, and you see the arguments that politicians raised against some of the ideas they were putting forward, and I'm seeing them get played out again now in the political circles, just nonsense articles, nonsense arguments about what might happen if X does Y, then, oh, you know, the children won't get fed and, you know, bad, the sky will fall. But the right conservative commentators were positing those arguments, you know, 120 years ago, and it's boring to see them redone now. And I think it'd be useful to illuminate how old and tired and stale some of those arguments are.
But that's a really fascinating point too. So, you know, 20 minutes ago I would have said Henry is a greater impact, but I was unaware that he's completely fallen out with a whole generation of Australians who would not recognise him or his poetry so much. So I think it's quite interesting now that you're talking about how she did everything that she did and was extraordinary, and in almost constant combat with somebody, while he does what he does, nicking words from mum, we won't go into that too much, but propped up by so many people. You know, all that correspondence that's, you know, guys at the Bulletin just slipping him a fiver and getting him over and doing this, that and the other, and even, you know, preferential treatment when he was in jail for being a, you know.
And his first book was more of a pamphlet. It was published by his mum. Like, a little bit embarrassing, dude. And I think as soon as it came out, he was embarrassed by it, and he talked later about squashing it. And apparently first editions of that are terribly hard to come by, and of course the library has two or three just sitting there. But again, I could handle
it. Making up for the missing issues of The Dawn.
That's right. And so he was absolutely supported and assisted by his mother, and then they fell out and it all. So perhaps it's like the French Revolution, it's too soon to tell. And you know, if we can give Louisa her moment in the sun, perhaps she'll be more influential in the longer term.
Okay, so one quick question before we turn over to everybody here. You've talked about a whole bunch of different things that she's done and the need to keep having those conversations 120 years later. What do you think is the most important lesson from her for us today?
That's a tricky one, and I think it goes back to that lesson of if you're going to put your head above the parapet, you're going to get shot down or you're going to get shot at. You're going to get vilified, particularly as a woman. I mean, look at Kamala Harris. You're going to get a whole lot of stones thrown in your direction, and you need to just keep going on regardless, as she did and as the women she worked with did. They didn't lose hope. They kept going in the face of that vilification. They kept going in the face of that harassment. They just kept going because they had to, because, as I said at the opening, what I was shocked about was how awful things were for women at that time. And something I just forgot to say at the beginning, and I'd like to put this in now. When I was looking at that edition of the Bulletin where Louisa was interviewed in 1896, I was looking at it in Trove so I could see the pictures and the ads. It's full of ads for abortion medicine. It's full of ads for abortion medicine, like not just one, pages and pages of women's pills to clear blockages. And effectively what they're doing is selling women a poison in the hope that they'd poison themselves and then that would solve the problem. That's the sort of world Louisa was standing up in, and she refused to publish those ads in her own paper. She called it medical quackery, quite rightly too. But that's the sort of horror that she was fighting against, and that's the sort of horrors that we're fighting against today in a global sense, that we can't afford to go back there. And so I think Louise's message in her fight is weirdly prescient for the times in which we find ourselves today.
Stay stubborn.
Yeah, stay stubborn. Annoy people. Piss people off.
Are there any questions? Otherwise, I will just ramble endlessly.
In the middle.
If you can wait for the microphone to come so that everybody can hear you, that would be fab. Thank you.
This might be an obvious source, but have you looked at the Jessie Street National Women's Library's holdings?
We were just talking about it today.
Today we did another sort of flurry of libraries. We looked at Jessie Street. I thought maybe the Society of Australian Genealogists Library might have them because they have all sorts of stuff. Mm. I think it's actually going to be lots of writing to librarians and asking them to physically go and check their shelves, because sometimes it's not even clear whether they have physical copies or if they just have it on microfilm. And if they have the microfilm, they've probably copied the one from the library, which shamefully is not as advertised on the box.
I rang the University of New England this afternoon and spoke to the librarians there, and they were delightful. And she said, oh, yeah, we've got them all there on microfiche. And I said, well, can you go and check? Oh, no, the microfiche machine's broken, so I can't. Like, and I don't really want to slog up to Armidale to find out that they haven't got them there.
I do have another question. It's all right. What sort of family did she come from? Where did she get her self-confidence?
That's a great question.
It is a great question.
A lot of these people have a religious background or a very strong somebody, grandmother, whatever, that drives, you know, gives them a model to.
No, she was a one-off. So her family of origin were, again, rural poverty. Her parents were farmers. She was the second of, I can't remember, a dozen children, like a lot. And her father did well as a labourer and then had his own brickworks and then was bankrupt and then he ran a pub for a while. And basically she had to get married at 17 because they couldn't afford to feed all their kids anymore. And so she was pressured to get married to this older man, Nils Larsen, who was Henry Lawson's father. So she came from rural poverty. There's
But ethnically what?
Oh, English. English.
Not Scottish, yeah.
No, and not convicts. They came out as free settlers. I think her father came out as a child as a free settler and her mum came out as a teenager as a free settler and then they met over here, but not a wealthy background, either of them, and not wealthy in the generations back. I have that information, but I don't have it up here. Oh, where in the colony they were farming? Around Mudgee.
They actually farmed in around Eurunderee.
Yeah, Eurunderee. Sorry, I thought you were asking where they were from in England.
Thank you.
No. So, yeah, Elizabeth, you're right. Louisa, Henry was famously born on the goldfields in a tent. Just have a think about that, ladies, how much fun that would be, giving birth to a baby in a tent. And then they, by the time he was about five or six, they moved to a farm at Eurunderee, which was the Henry's father picked it more because it was gold fossicking country rather than it was good pasture, so it was pretty tenuous farming land. So it was at Eurunderee, and Louisa's wider family were settled around Mudgee. And of course, Henry's father was from Norway, and as far as I know, they never had any contact again with the father's family. Which one do you want to do first? One at the back or one at the front? Oh, and another one here. Okay.
Just two comments, really. About 10 years ago, Paul Brunton, who used to be at the State Library, gave a very good paper at the art gallery about the portrait, I think by Tom Roberts, in the art gallery of Henry Lawson. And it had quite a story attached to it because I think it was Archibald wanted done.
John Longstaff.
I knew it was someone famous. And he organised... when Lawson had scrounged money from someone else to go to England, I think with his family, Archibald arranged for him to call in on Longstaff in Melbourne and have the portrait done. But remembering just the sort of detail that Paul Brunton went into, it'd be worth trying to get, and Rachel will probably tell you how to contact him, his talk, because it might have some... sort of sideways stuff which might be of interest. And I think Louisa lived in Phillip Street, Sydney, didn't she?
Yep, she did in Phillip Street. I've been there. There's no house there now. There's just a big glossy building. And she lived at a few different sites around the CBD and then ended up in Marrickville. But, yes, for a while she published The Dawn out of Phillip Street.
And the other thing is you talked about the vilification of women, including her. I mean, that didn't stop.
No.
In the 20s, Jack Lang brought in the widow's pension. And, I mean, this is, 25 years after what you're talking about. And the Conservatives in Parliament went berserk about it. They said this will encourage promiscuity. Women who should get remarried after their husband had died, they won't.
Yep.
They'll live in sin so they can get the women's pension or the widow's pension. And on it went for days and days in Parliament. And, of course, it was just an attack on women.
Yeah. Louisa, one of the things she was arguing for as well as the vote was to raise the age of consent, because at the time the age of consent for women was 14 years old. And the arguments against raising the age of consent were appalling. It was basically men arguing that they should be able to rape 14-year-old girls and get away with it. It's shocking. Actually, the sorts of nonsensical things they'd go for. I will look into that article. Thank you for that. And some of the... So I will get to the questions I haven't forgotten about you. But some of the other information that comes up is just as interesting. So Henry was one of five children, and they were all pretty talented. One of them died very young. Louisa had five children, Henry, Charles, Peter, and then two little girls who were twins, and one of the twins died at 9 months old, and I don't know that Louisa ever got over it. But those boys were all talented. So Peter, the third brother, was a musician, and he was a one-hit wonder. He had a hit song that was the hit waltz of the season, and the governor's daughter had it at her wedding, and in the back of Henry's little book that his mum published was an ad for his brother's sheep music.
She is a good mum, isn't she?
Yeah, so she would have hated that. And the second son, Charlie, could draw. His drawings are in the scrapbooks in the library. So Henry, I want to situate Henry within that family milieu, I guess, rather than just focusing on Henry. Sorry, there's a question, the lady with the beautiful headscarf on at the back, and then we'll come down. I've been admiring that headscarf. It's very nice.
Hi, thank you very much. A couple of years ago, Peter and I walked the streets of Sydney trying to locate where the Kwong Tat tea rooms.
I love Kuang Tao.
Yes.
I love him so much.
The story behind that was that it was illegal for women to gather and discuss the politics of suffrage. And so they had a scone and tea afternoon.
Nice.
And to me, that's not the sign of a monster. That's the sign of women being smart and getting away with doing something illegal in a way that gives them the opportunity to gather and talk. And it's just begging for people to realise how hard it is and was to be a woman in a man's world. But think about the women in England, you know, and how they were treated for another 30 years.
That's right.
It's darn hard. And she was smart.
Did you ever find Kuang Tat's tea room?
You know the glass building in, is it King Street?
King Street.
That was built over it.
Yeah.
Okay. But he also had one tea room in the QVB building area.
What occurs to me, and this occurred to me when I was looking at the minutes of SAMHSA, is they have a ladies' reading room in that beautiful building down the road. I'm probably pointing in the wrong direction, but you know where I mean. And they had a ladies' reading room. And I think part of the reason why Louisa joined the committee was to advocate for improving the ladies' reading room. I'm just working on that at the moment. But you need to... The fun part about doing this research is thinking it through. So if you're a lady in Sydney in 1890, where do you go to the toilet? Where do you adjust yourself? Where do you pause? Kuang Tat's tea rooms is an obvious contender, but the places like SAMHSA would have been absolutely crucial for that. And particularly if you've had 12 children, well, ladies, your pelvic floor ain't going to be what it used to be, quite frankly. And so it was a disincentive for women to come to the city and to come shopping because there weren't the facilities there for them. So places like SAMHSA and their ladies' reading room were absolutely crucial, not just for their intellectual well-being but for women's physical well-being as well. And so thinking through those implications of context and things is one of the fun and interesting parts of doing this sort of research and finding characters like Kuang Tat, who I just adore. Yeah. Google him. He's just wonderful.
And why a scarf is always essential.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a question down the front.
All right. Thank you, Michelle and Rachel. That was absolutely fascinating to me. And I maybe we can have a coffee or a drink one day because there's so much to discuss. Because as you said, I've been working in the drover's wife world and have my own feminist retelling of it. And it's interesting when you look back at those times, how much of history and how many people are connected to each other. So you just mentioned Jack Lang here. Well, of course, he was Henry Lawson's brother-in-law. And Kuang Tat's tea rooms. Well, chapter one of my book is set there. So we're all talking the same language. Yeah. So what I was going to ask you was, you talked about how a lot of the biographies paint Louisa Lawson quite negatively. Brian Matthews less so, but she's very shadowy in that. And Grant Lee Keyser wasn't too nasty, I thought, on her. But also a lot of the women's writing that have existed in this space have also not been kind to Louisa Lawson. So, and I'm thinking there, and famous women, so I'm thinking there of, well, Henry's wife, Bertha, definitely not a fan of Louisa.
No.
Mary Gilmore, not a fan.
She wasn't a fan of anybody.
No. And nor, there's also I don't know, it's a creative biography, kind of Kerry Davies' book, A Wife's Heart, about the relationship between Henry and Bertha.
Yeah.
So none of them liked her. So I've given her a nicer rap, you'll be pleased to know. But yeah. So what do you think about the women also being very hard on her?
With Bertha, who was Henry's wife and so Louisa's daughter-in-law, they're a different generation. And I do fear that Louisa treated Bertha quite harshly. Bertha fell on hard times when Henry was failing to support his family and she really needed the money and Louisa just wasn't there for her at that time. And so that I don't blame Bertha for having issues under those circumstances. We don't know the full story. We won't ever know the full story, but it's pretty brutal. Mary Gilmore, again, different generation. She's Henry's generation, not Louisa's generation. And I think Louisa just sort of looked at her and just thought, no, you're nonsense. Just don't.
She wasn't one to suffer fools.
No.
And I'm not saying Mary Gilmore was a fool, to be clear, but yeah.
But I also think that she was possibly a bit protective about her son in the way some mothers can be a bit weird about those sorts of things. And that biography of Bertha and Henry, A Wife's Heart, I love it. I think it's a beautiful biography and it's really interesting and insightful and it does include the biographer very much as a character within that biography. And so I think it's okay that Louise is not a perfect person. Who of us is? She's not... what I don't want to write is a hagiography that's, you know, Louisa's a fabulous angel, and I don't want to write her as a monster either. If I can find that middle ground where she's a human being full of faults and positive things and talents, then I think I'll have done all right.
I totally agree. And the way I like to think of Henry and Louisa, I think I said that you can almost think of them as two sides of the same coin, sort of teetering between brilliance and despair, both of them struggling a lot in their lives.
Absolutely. And Henry, even in his autobiographical fragment, he writes like an angel. He really does. And he's a better writer than his mother. Mm. His mum's just better at organising stuff and actually getting her stuff out into the world.
Well, I can't wait for it to come out.
2027, coming soon. if Michelle can get the manuscript finished by 2026.
At all good bookstores everywhere. We probably have time to squash in one more question.
Thanks, it's been a terrific night. We've got a special relationship here with Tom Keneally, and it's a very long time since I read In Search of Henry Lawson, and I can't remember what he said about Louisa. Have you talked to Tom about your book or your research?
Not yet, and to be fair, I'm very much at the early stages of my research, and so I feel a bit of a fraud sitting up here being the Louisa Lawson expert when literally today I'm still looking through her letters and her diaries. So I have a long to-do list, and that's definitely on my to-do list.
Well, you heard it here, 2027, Louisa Lawson as a real woman that we can identify with, get frustrated at, and I think also in many ways be grateful to. So thank you very much to our friends here at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts for hosting and organising and wrangling both of us. Thank you all very much for coming. And we hope to see you here or out in the real world or in Bookland or some of you on social media soon. Thank you very much. And thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, Rachel.
A huge thank you to Rachel and to Michelle for such an interesting conversation. Also, thank you to our live audience and those listening at home. This event was partnered with the State Library of New South Wales and the History Council of New South Wales and was part of this year's History Week offering.